Heaton, I don't know whether or not I can recommend this to Jen yet, but I do know that I can recommend this book to you immediately. Have only listened to 2 hours of it. Newt Gingrich has written a book about the rise of the Republican Revolution in 1994. It's very, very good in terms of at least him being honest about races he lost and why he lost. And he is an absolute nerd in terms of his ability to recall various different political things. But you have made mention that one of your goals on the Political Orphanage is to interview Newt Gingrich about his love for zoos, right?
Uh-huh. Yep. He's agreed to come on the show, but his fucking people keep stopping him from doing it. So yes, that is one of my goals.
Well, now he's got a book to promote.
Zoos as in animal prisons?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And
yes. He's a big zoo fan.
And do you know his origin on why he is a big zoo guy?
I do not.
As an 11-year-old, his origin of getting into politics was realizing that where he grew up in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, did not have a zoo, and he loved zoos, and he had been to a bunch of zoos around, and so he just decided Harrisburg should have a zoo, walked to City Hall as a precocious 11-year-old and said, I would like to find the levers of government for which could make a zoo happen. He talked to the city planning officer, who thought he was adorable. He went to a city council meeting, and it wound up not only getting covered locally, but became a international story because of the Associated Press that a precocious 11-year-old was asking city council to bring a zoo to Harrisburg.
I find this very funny that the closest thing to the bete noir of effective polarization that exists in almost all discourse began to bring zoos to Harrisburg. That's amazing.
Because bringing zoos to Harrisburg. Yeah.
Thank you for talking. I'm going to see if I can't get him as a guest thing, because I find that it's a lot easier for me to get guests swinging above my weight when they've got a book to promote.
Yeah.
And then you develop a relationship with some of the publishing houses, and they go, oh shit, you actually read the book? And I'm like, yes, I read the book. And they're like, wow, okay. Anything else? And I'm like, yeah, if you want, I could do it in advance. We could release it the same week the book comes out. And they're like,
You're amazing.
And so like I'm beginning to get more traction there. So if the book's already out, I might've missed that. Is it fairly recent? Is he still doing media?
I don't know whether or not he's still doing media. I do know that it was recommended on Audible. I've essentially decided that I'm going to stop listening to all but like two non-political podcasts. I'm going to absolutely overdose on political media. All I'm going to be listening to is political podcasts and reading political books. I'm going to just go into a coma. I'm going to be more campaign than man by the time that the primaries start.
Great.
Nice.
Good luck, friends.
I think that's going to be fun. You know what? One of the finest podcasts I've ever heard is Raise the Dead. It's one of my absolute all-time favorites. And that is you going into like Mintat level campaign analysis with
yes.
really superior storytelling skills. And I would love for you to apply that to the current situation in a way that makes me think I'm watching a movie rather than the downfall of civilization. That would be terrific if you could do that.
I'll tell you, I think I would really get along with Newt Gingrich, because Newt Gingrich has a savant level knowledge. That and his co-author on this, who he worked with in Congress, they have a savant level knowledge. In fact, the origin story of, I believe his name is Joe Gaylord, who is his co-author and partner in crime for a lot of this. His origin story in the book is that he watched every minute of the 1960 and 1964 convention coverage for the Republicans. And this is in a world where there is no VCR, no DVR. There's no recordability. That means that a child just sat in front of the television and didn't leave for, like, I can't get through YouTube videos of 1960 and 1964 convention coverage. It is just a lot of slow pans of old men smoking. And this child was so obsessed with it. He knew the rules to the point where when the 1968 convention came around, there was a floor fight between Ford and Reagan. And this guy, as a youngster, was on the rule committee and knew enough to be able to mediate it because he had been so obsessed with the previous two.
I think you found some intellectual bedfellows to hang out with.
I'm juiced. Rock hard.
Ready
this
for
is,
bed.
This is awesome. This is awesome.
But wait, but also the nice thing about that though, Justin, is like I think you've figured out what I've figured out over time is when you're interviewing big guests, or if you meet them in real life, this is a good tip in real life. You meet a big person that you're like, oh, I'm very intimidated to talk to them. Go talk to them about the thing that they're obsessed with that no one asks them about. So like if you meet, theoretically, you meet Taylor Swift, don't talk to her about her music. Talk to her about
cats.
I don't know what Taylor Swift likes. Maybe cats.
She likes
cats.
There's
got to be something else though. There's she's really into like Rwanda or something like that. Like go for that. Right. But I think with you, Justin, because there are the political super nerds, because when I was paging in the Oklahoma state legislature, which was my intro to the political world, like some of the legislators would come in and they would like gleefully talk about how much they enjoyed reading Robert's Rules of Order.
Yeah.
Like that they had read the entirety of Robert's Rules of Order. And like you could tell they were chomping at the bit to talk to other people about Robert's Rules of Order. Like they didn't really want to do the thing about like, well, you know, in my district, we believe in hard work, Jesus, and growing legumes. Like what they wanted to talk about was why Mason's Rules of Order was inferior. And like, so you could totally do that with these guys and be like, well, how did you get past cloture? And they'd be like, oh, great story. I'll sit down for this one.
I'll tell you. Yeah. Anyway, I'm super excited. I got that. That's what I'm reading now. And then I'm going to get to, there's a new book about Biden that is apparently pretty good that an Atlantic author wrote about his first term in office here. So
can you recommend to me a good book on Nixon? Because I find that guy endlessly fascinating. He's like the Richard III of American politics. And I keep like recently I found it. Jen, you know, he's the one that nationalized Amtrak. That's Nixon. Yeah. Like, and then apparently he was in favor of scrapping the Electoral College. Like every time I read about him, I'm like, this is not what I thought he was going to do. So I would love to read a biography of that guy. Cause he's turned into the star of Lion King in American politics. And like, there was just something else going on.
The first thing to start with is, and I think it's an audiobook now, is Making of the President 1960. That was one of the books that I based Raise the Dead on, but it is very much of a different era. Like it is very much a flowery prose of that election, but that's Nixon versus Kennedy. And you'll get a lot of good Nixon color. And then as things go on, obviously things get rougher for him. Jen, you seem thrilled by this conversation. You seem riveted by the political book club for which I want to start.
Jen, I explicitly brung up Amtrak to get you excited. What do you want from us?
I'm just waiting for this conversation to end.
From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young. From Butte, Montana,
I'm Jen Briney.
And from Edinburgh, Scotland,
I'm Andrew Heaton.
And we're not wrong on this edition of the program. We're going to talk about the gerontocracy of our government. Yet more conversation after Mitch McConnell has another freeze and some reporting around Dianne Feinstein and her crumbling financial reality with her family. And then we have some infighting amongst the Democratic Party on immigration and whether or not that issue has changed materially. All that and your emails. Jen, you are in Butte, Montana. What is the weather like in Butte?
Well, today it's 75 and sunny and perfect. And we could have used this a couple of days ago because we were here for a golf tournament and it was a 3-day tournament. The first day was gorgeous. The second day we had a really gnarly thunderstorm that came through right in the middle of it. We were able to get back out there, but on the hole 12, It started raining and it was cold, and me and all the rest of the girls were like, we're going to the bar. Yeah. Fun golfing. See we're ya. Done. Yeah. And so we spent, I don't know, like 8 hours in the bar after that. And then Monday they had to completely cancel because it was 50 degrees and raining the whole day and the course was a mess. And so, yeah, we could have used 75 and sunny on Monday, but I'm glad the boys got at least 2 days out there, and it was a lot of fun. The people in this town are the absolute best. I love coming here.
Well, considering you love thunderstorms a lot more than you like golf, this sounds like an absolute win for you.
Yeah, I actually had to pretend that I was like all upset about it, but the truth was it was awesome.
I was going to say, because I've never heard you talk about how awesome golf is, but I have heard you wax rhapsodic about how amazing thunderstorms are.
Well, the only issue I have with it is that there's a bunch of people that I love waving around metal sticks in the middle of this thunderstorm. Yeah. And I'm like, hey, morons, like, it's time to go inside. Like, I'm sending them the weather alerts that I'm getting where I'm like, severe storm incoming. I'm showing them the picture with all the lightning. I'm being ignored, and they kept playing until the horn went off. And I'm like, no, respect the Weather Channel, not the horn that is being blown by people that are busy doing other things. So I had to have a little talk with my husband about metal sticks and thunderstorms, but there was no more lightning after that. So no more fights.
Well, the Senate is back in session this week. And with it comes two senators who are again in the news for their failing health. Mitch McConnell froze at another press conference last week, this one in his home state of Kentucky. This is his second such incident, as the first one happened a few months back in D.C. McConnell was away from the Senate after his fall earlier this year, and his staff chalked this up to lightheadedness. GOP presidential hopeful Nikki Haley has made term limits and competency tests for politicians over 75 a campaign issue, and even named McConnell during an appearance on Face the Nation this week. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, Dianne Feinstein will also return amidst more drama over her health. A Politico article last week tells the tale of a messy family financial battle between the Dianne Feinstein's adult daughter and the adult children of her late husband. The biggest revelation in a battle over millions of dollars in assets and property is the complete absence of Feinstein as her children divvy up the assets. Essentially, when it comes to money, she's being treated as an elder who does not have any agency or say in what's going to happen. And for the residents of California, who have only two Senate votes, she is being treated as somebody with full control over her mental facilities. And by the way, all of this happens as our two leading candidates for the presidency of the United States at the time of this recording are 77 and 80 years old, respectively. So, Jen, politicians refusing to relinquish power is nothing new, but do you think there is a change in our culture since we can see and hear their decline far more accurately in the digital age?
I have to hope so, because there does seem to be a backlash to this, especially now that it was one thing when it was one member of the Democratic Party, Dianne Feinstein, who was obviously having problems. But now it's Mitch McConnell. So we have a Democrat, we have a Republican. It's now being proven that it's a bipartisan problem. And a lot of people are talking about it. And so I do think that there's an awareness of it now that is probably good for us, because my biggest issue with this, first of all, this is kind of new. We said that it's not new that, you know, politicians stay in office, but it actually is. So when we were born in the early 1980s, the median age in the House was in the late 40s. And then in the Senate, it was in the mid 50s. Now in the House, the median age is 58. And in the Senate, we're at 65. So there has been an increase in the median age in the people that are representing us in Congress. But the median age of the U.S. population is 38. And so when I look at how we are being represented and by whom, I think there's actual policy ramifications of this, like aside from the fact that like Dianne Feinstein doesn't seem to know where she is, because like, look at what's been accomplished in the last 20 years. The first thing that comes to my mind is we got this huge unpaid for prescription drug for seniors plan, the Medicare Part D plan. But the stuff that's not being addressed is like, housing problems for young people, mainly because the boomers are sitting on all of these homes and don't want to give them up. And then we have student loans with the interest and the debt. We've talked about these things. There are so many issues for young people that are not being addressed because 54% of our Congress overall are members of the silent and boomer generations. So they're legislating things that they can identify with that help their generations. I don't think it's anything malicious, but it just is what it is. Like, you legislate the problems that you're aware of. And I just don't know how aware a Congress that is that elderly is of the people that are younger and what we're going through. So I think it's a big problem. And I think we're waking up to it. And I think that's probably going to be a good thing. And I'm hoping that we'll start to vote accordingly and start to vote some of these people out. Cause I'm still not in favor of term limits. I feel like if someone is representing you well, we should have the option of keeping them as long as we want. At the end of the day, this is up to us voters to take care of. This is our responsibility. We never should have elected Dianne Feinstein because the problems were there 6 years ago when she was running. So this is really the voters' fault, and it's for the voters to fix. And I'm hoping that the spotlight on Dianne Feinstein and Mitch McConnell and Chuck Grassley and Tom Carper, I mean, we have very, very old people outside, Nancy Pelosi, they're all in their 80s. So I'm hoping that with an election coming
Bernie up, Sanders turns 82 this week, this Friday.
I know, but he's one of those examples of, I think he's still there mentally. And if the people of Vermont still want to be represented by him, I think that's their choice. But I do think the voters need to look at their candidates. Like, if you have Mitch McConnell freezing, they put out a press release where they're like, yeah, this is a thing that just happens after major concussions, as if that was better somehow. But I think the people of Kentucky, the people of California, like the people that are having elderly people on their ballot, you really have to take that into account. And I think maybe starting with this upcoming election, we will be more conscious of age, especially because it's also a big conversation in our presidential race as well. I think it's going to start to be a factor, and I think it's a good thing for our country if it is.
Heaton, you know, when I say that there are people that we've had ugly situations in the Senate and the House before, while the median age might have moved up, we certainly have had examples of the Strom Thurmonds of the world that have had to be peeled out of that chamber. What are your thoughts on this?
I was actually thinking about Strom Thurmond earlier today. He wasn't in the House when I worked there, but I did, when I went on a school trip to Washington for the first time, he was in the Senate, and I was able to see him. He wasn't wheeled out. It was like he had two really beefy bodyguards that carried a skeleton into the floor of the Senate. I mean, he was, I believe he was approaching 100. Like, I'm not exaggerating. Yeah. I think he die at 100, if I got that right?
I will look that up, but continue your take.
I mean, it was like the Crypt Keeper. And at that point, I think it had all been delegated to his staff. The age thing, I think, is not new. Jen makes a good point with the median age increasing. That doesn't surprise me. And I think if anything, that's probably going to increase in our society and others, just given that lifespans are potentially longer, particularly for people that are on top of things, affluent and in good condition. So I think you're going to see people wanting to remain in office longer than they might have in the past. But even then, when you look at like outgoing Senate majority floor leaders, the ages for them, it tends to be, and I don't know why this is, 55 or 72. Those tend to be the two ages that people leave the Senate majority. But like, there's a lot of 72, and there's lots of people that are in their, 80s that have done it. Like John Dingell was around forever. I believe his wife now has a seat. His daughter now has the seat. I appreciate the position that term limits are bad because they limit the democratic process. But I don't have a problem with term limits. I do have a problem with age limits. I think that those are based in identity, and I don't like making laws based in identity. I don't mind there being term limits, though. The idea that you get to be here for X amount of time, or even you could play with it in different ways to, I think, at least kind of break up the permanent inertia that candidates are able to get over time. So in Oklahoma, the governor, you can serve as many terms as you want as governor. You just can't do them consecutively. So you could do two terms as governor. You have to sit a term out. Then you can come back if you want. But there's at least some chances for people to come in. We've talked about previously on the program, and I really like this idea, that you're in for three terms or something. And then after that, you have to get 5% more every time. And then it caps out at 80% or something like that. So that,
can I ask you, number one, Strom Thurmond died at 100 and served in the Senate until he was 98 years old for Strom Thurmond.
I'd love to know what the thing that was that broke the camel's back on that, where he was like, now I truly can 90.
He went out with his term. Was that it? Yeah. At 98, another 6 years was off the table. he couldn't push a term to leave at 104.
I was talking to my dad a couple of years ago, and we were reminiscing about members of our family, and we brought up his grandmother, my great grandmother, and he went, "Oh, Grandma Bickle, yeah, Grandma Bickle, tough old bird, Grandma Bickle, went blind 92, quit driving 94, died at 98, nearly made it to 100." And I was like, "Did you say that she quit driving at 94 2 years after she went blind?" And he was like, "Well, yeah, but she knew Alva really well. Like, she knew all the turns and stuff. So she just memorized how to get to the grocery store. She was a drive. That's what Strom Thurmond was doing." Wow. At best, what he was doing. I think that there are things that we could put in place that I would be fine with. I would be fine with there being term limits. I like the idea of there being some kind of, look, if you're going to be here for 40 years, you have to have a higher amount of popularity than incumbents or something like that. That doesn't really bother me either. That said, they'd probably do it. Don Young was also in the Senate forever. I mean, he came in just after Alaskan statehood and only died maybe 3 years ago. I don't think that the population is likely to vote out people that are old, merely based on that, for a couple of reasons. One, you're generally going to have in a non-compulsory voting system, people that have more free time are going to vote more than young people, which is to say old people are going to vote. So you're going to have people that are more sympathetic to people in their age group voting that are going to be less likely to do that than, say, having a bunch of 25-year-olds or 21-year-olds voting. And then the other thing is, when you've got somebody that's represented a district for a really long time, everybody in the district feels this like connection with them and the sense of identity and like, my dad plays bridge with a senator or whatever. They went to high school together. And I think it would be very difficult to actually get somebody not elected in their district based on senility. I don't think it's a big factor. Otherwise we would be doing it right now. Where for me, this becomes kind of relevant on a structural level is that we have term limits in, I think it's like, for judges, we have term limits in 49 states or age limits in 49 states. I think Rhode Island, to my knowledge, is the only state in the union that doesn't have some sort of limit for judges. Every other state's figured out how to do that. Term limits for legislators is a lot less. I think there's only 13 states in the union that have that right now. But it strikes me as the kind of thing where there's going to be more activity and more fluidity on that electoral level when you get further down. When you get up to that national level, there's so many machinations in place that maintain the status quo that the only way you'd ever get term limits in is if you had like an Andrew Yang style system where it doesn't apply to whoever voted on it. It only applies to incoming people.
Briony is not for term limits, but you said you were. So if you were going to do it and I am making you emperor for a day, is it on a federal level or is it state by state?
States can do whatever they want. I would recommend that they do that. I think I think you got
to
be careful.
So you would like to see that on a state level, that Florida would say you can only serve two terms as senator, whereas a federal, and I don't even know if this is how it works. I don't think you can. I think that that's a federal office no matter what, but, if it were possible, you would prefer for states to determine whether or not their senators could serve infinite terms versus it being a federal law where everybody in the chamber only serves X amount of terms.
Well, I would, at a federal level, I would put in term limits for senators and congressmen for sure.
So you would, that's put a federal level. Yeah. So you would say federally, you would like to.
I just
say
wouldn't
that.
Make a federal law co-opting those legislatures. But if I were in Congress, what I would do is, how about this? You can serve 20 years in the United States Congress. 20 years is a long time, and you can do it in either chamber, slice it up however you want.
It'd have to be divisible by six, right? Yeah. So it'd have to be 18 or 24.
Well, you could theoretically get appointed to a Senate position. So there's some way to, you could mathematically make the case it would happen.
But
for
let's
sure.
Not let's
make
do, it do, come on. We're even,
yeah, yeah. Okay. No, I think if
18
if you
or 24,
short,
pick it.
If you cut it too short, 18 years, fine. You cut it too short.
And on the 18th birthday, he found out it wasn't his.
you risk losing institutional knowledge, which I think has happened in California, where they, maybe they've rectified this now, but a few years ago, when I would talk to people that were involved in government over there, they indicated to me that the term limits had been set too early to where basically by the time you'd learned a sufficient amount to actually adjust the governance of budget, and just where the budget was, you had to leave. So you run a risk with that and you don't want to set it too early, but I feel like 18, 24 years is a sufficient amount of time to get done whatever you wanted to get done. And you run the risk of just having people dominate that forever. And I think the system will naturally protect incumbents. And I don't think it's likely to result in voters kicking out people that are otherwise floundering.
The thing about this that fascinates me is you often hear of politicians that look at the Strom Thurmonds of the world and say, oh God, never me, never me. I would assume probably even Dianne Feinstein and Mitch McConnell themselves at some point looked at Strom Thurmond and said, geez, that's so sad. You're clinging to this in a way that is, you know, really, really ugly to see. And then they get older and, you know, you still think that you're good enough. Everything's fine. And obviously there's a lot going on, so you can't leave, blah, 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 blah. I wonder if that changes because our media is able to spread this stuff so fast and so far that Mitch McConnell froze at a press conference in Kentucky and it was international news in 30 minutes. That was not the case with Strom Thurmond. We did not have the same kind of HD video that we have now where everybody has a camera in their pocket and they're going to show this kind of decline. We don't have the same ability to spread Dianne Feinstein's handler telling her to vote aye or nay that is caught on a live mic that spreads as far as it does now. So I don't know. I wonder if that goes into the calculus of a politician's mind to say, you know, and even let's say a Bernie Sanders, Dianne Feinstein, when she got elected, granted, she was not in the situation that she's in now, but she was cognizant when she got elected 6 years ago. She's essentially being rolled around and being whispered everything she says at this point. But if you are a Bernie Sanders, if you are a Chuck Grassley, you got to wonder, hey, is the next 6 years going to be a lot different than what I feel like right now?
Well, and historically, your staff could cover for you. Like, I think this is one of the reasons that you see states, the vast majority of states have some kind of term limit or age limit for judges. Because when judges start to get to that point, the other judges come in and talk to them and go, hey, you're about to cast doubt on all of your previous decisions over the last 10 years. All the decisions you've made are going to be potentially up for grabs and in an appellate court because you might be senile and people are going to think that. So if you want to protect the corpus of work that you've done, you need to tap out now. But there's no incentive for that in Congress or the Senate or in the House or the Senate. Like you could up until social media really got big, like you could kind of have your staff cover for you and you could be a ceremonial figurehead and delegate the things out and you could kind of operate as a committee for a while. And if you weren't making great decisions all the time as a member of Congress, arguably very few of them are doing that while compos mentis anyway. So it'd be very difficult to see that.
Well, and there's a level of shame you need to have in general to be concerned about things like this. And I think people, you know, I'm thinking about Dianne Feinstein and Mitch McConnell in general, like even before they had these dementia issues, Dianne Feinstein, her husband was profiting off of what she was doing in the Senate. And then there's Mitch McConnell. I mean, there's example after example. These are shameless people. So I think you would have to be someone who would be afraid of being embarrassed. And these two people clearly are not. And so I don't know. I don't think it's going to make that big of a difference for them to be like, oh, I might be embarrassed on camera, because they're just, you have to have shame to be afraid of being embarrassed. And they didn't in their jobs. So why would they in their, and also a lot of people with dementia aren't fully aware of how far gone they are. So you'd also have to have the self-awareness of like, oh, I'm really losing it here. Where a lot of times they don't see it. It's the people around you that see it, but the person who's experiencing it, they think their thoughts are their thoughts and that they're rational. So it's, I don't know. I don't know when these people would have the point where they're like, okay, I'm really losing it now. I need to step away, because wouldn't wouldn't Dianne Feinstein have hit that point by now? Wouldn't Mitch McConnell, like, if it's not happening now, why would it happen in the future?
Because, I mean, if these guys are being embarrassed and some people in their own party are turning on them, and that might affect the legacy, I would not be appealing to their shame. I would be appealing to their ego and whatever they imagine their legacy would be going forward. I will draw a bit of a line between Feinstein and McConnell. McConnell has...
But McCausal's pausing.
Yes.
He's rebooting.
He talks
but the processor
regularly.
Works once it reboots.
Yes. Like Dianne Feinstein, like they don't she's put gone. A live mic in front of her.
Yeah.
Because they are afraid she's going to say something embarrassing because she's repeatedly said incredibly embarrassing things that makes people believe that she has no idea where she is. And by the way, let me recommend. Feinstein is a silent character in her sad and messy final chapter is the article by Politico. It goes out of its way to tiptoe around the fact that the actual lead in this story is when it comes to money, her children are not making any bones about the fact that she's not here anymore. They are acting as if she is already dead. She's a lawyer. She is a very powerful person. If she wanted to have say over her beach house, her assets, she very, very, very well could. She's not. And the reason why is because that Dianne Feinstein isn't around anymore. And her family is treating her like that.
But she kind of was 5 years ago when she was running for office. There were already stories coming out saying like she's losing it and she still ran for office. So that's why I'm saying like, I don't know if this is going to have an effect, because even Dianne Feinstein, the stories were out. The rumors were there. It was a part of the California election. I remember talking about it and being like, we can't elect this woman. And yet we did. The fact that she still ran when she knew she was declining, and yet, you know, there were signs that this was going to happen and she still ran. So I just think that people that have this level of ego and don't have the shame, I don't see this making a big difference for people going forward just because it's not making a big difference for them now. Again, I think it's up to the voters to look at these people and be like, will you be able to represent me? And that's where the voters failed in that case.
Yeah.
Hey, Justin, you mentioned a moment ago that Nikki Haley is running on term limits, but I believe you also said a cognitive test.
Yes. Cognitive test testing. Over 75 for anybody over 75.
So the senators are going to do like a walk the line with police? Are they going to do math problems? Like, did she spell out what that looks like?
She has not issued the Haley test that I have seen thus far, but I would imagine it's something along the lines of, you know, like drawing a clock or whatever those kinds of dementia tests are.
So you remember, we talked about this a couple of years ago. The reason that we call circuit judges is because they used to literally write a circuit.
Yes.
And if you go back to early American history, Supreme Court judges were the appellate judges on the circuit. They their powers combined like in Captain Planet once a year to go do Supreme Court decisions. But the rest of the time, they were expected to be a judge running around the circuit. So I think if you can ride a horse, you're okay. I think that should be the thing. We make everybody ride a horse. And if they can ride a horse in their district to the Capitol, they're fine. And if they can't do it, get somebody else.
Save a horse, ride an appellate judge.
Yeah.
Patreon.com/We're Not Wrong is where you need to go to support this show. And folks, I think this is the month. I think that September 2023, we're going to hit 1,000 patrons. We need about 60 more, but I got a feeling that this is going to be the month that it happens. So can you be in that final 60? Well, only you can answer that. And we're going to give you something for your money. You get a bonus topic each and every week. It comes out right after this main show comes out. And this week, we're going to be talking about online trolling and the gleeful weaponization of death in the age of COVID. There's a very, very good Atlantic article.
It was a great article. I'm really glad you picked that one. I'm looking forward to talking about it.
Yeah, about the proliferation of not only the Herman Cain Award Facebook group, but also the hashtag Died Suddenly Facebook group. Two sides of the laughing about dead people coin that COVID gave us. But a lot to talk through on that one. And it's yours. Patreon.com/wherenotwrong if you become a patron. Let's talk about immigration, huh? The Biden administration finds itself in a tight spot as it grapples with mounting pressure surrounding the escalating migrant crisis in several major cities in the United States. Shelters nationwide are brimming to capacity, and thousands of immigrants have been pouring into cities like New York, Boston, and Chicago. The humanitarian crisis is, according to many local politicians, reaching a critical point. Democratic leaders, alongside business communities, are urging the federal government to enhance their efforts in accommodating the migrants, expressing disappointment over what they perceive as President Biden's inadequate response. Amid this crisis, city officials and advocacy groups pinpoint the slow work permit process as a primary cause of the prolonged stay of migrants in shelters, despite DHS officials asserting that the new program have cut down the average waiting time significantly. Meanwhile, local municipalities are engulfed in blame games with prominent figures such as New York City Mayor Eric Adams and New York State Governor Kathy Hochul openly criticizing each other and the Biden administration over the handling of this crisis. While the administration is facing calls for declaring a federal emergency, it emphasizes the substantial federal funds already allocated to addressing the issue. Tensions have escalated further at the local level with public outrage over perceived misallocation of said resources. But despite the grim circumstances, the Biden administration is undertaking initiative like new parole and alert systems to streamline the work permit process, urging a collective effort which will help navigate this crisis. Heaton, until recently, immigration conversations were largely centered around border states, which are by and large either red or purple. Does the frustration of blue northern cities change the political calculus on the immigration question?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's a good conversation to have and a good calculus to reinvestigate. I think that to a great extent, immigration has been a abstract concept for all people involved the last 10, 20 years, where a lot of the people that are anti-immigrant just kind of don't like the idea of immigrants. And it's like, well, hey, maybe they're going to Chicago and you don't need to worry about it. It doesn't affect you. Don't worry. Alternately, I think a lot of people that are pro-immigrant are like, it's great in principle. And then when they actually come to their community are like, oh, it turns out there's trade-offs. I hadn't anticipated this. So I think that having an actual conversation about how to do this in a way that it's not just a border issue abstract concept is a very productive one. Like from where I'm at, it would make sense to do it more emergently rather than top down and go, hey, cities, how many people do you think that you could take in? States, how many people do you think you could take in? Because that's going to be a more accurate reflection of what the American people are either capable of or want, as opposed to having a national policy that then affects just select areas. I'm very, very pro-immigrant. I think that, like for the permits, for example, I just come work here. I think if somebody has a company and they want to hire somebody else, that's fine. And I, other than that person not being a criminal, I don't think it needs to be anything more than that. So I'm very much come to America. That's terrific. But when we're dealing with migrant issues, I understand the idea that there's going to be a bottleneck and oversaturation at the breaking points. And that is a legitimate position to have. And so having communities say, you know, we want to step up, we want to have more neighbors, new neighbors, and we can take in these people, I think is a better way of approaching that rather than trying to do a top-down one. And you've had some good conversations about this that I think would do well to shift some of the elements in the system. Pete Buttigieg, when he was running for president back in 2020, had an idea for a thing called a location-based visa or a place-based visa, which I thought was a terrific idea. You have places like Akron, Ohio, and Detroit, Michigan, and Rust Belt cities that are in this kind of slow-moving death spiral where people are leaving the city, which means that they've got less of a tax base to fund government services, but you still have to do the government services. So either the taxes go up or the services get worse, and then people leave the city. And it creates this negative feedback loop. What Buttigieg wanted to do was go, if you're a company and you say, we need more H-1 visas for this particular field, which, by the way, corporate America has lots of examples of this, where they're like, we are not getting a sufficient amount of immigrants for what we want to do. because there's not enough people in our own labor market in the United States. So you could say, oh, great. So you guys are working in the pharmaceutical industry. If any city wants to get H-1 visas for this, then sign up on the list and we'll just let people come in and do that. And then the deal that Buttigieg had was come in for 3 years to one of these places. And once you've been there 3 years and you've been a part of that tax base and you've been a part of that community, you get a green card to work anywhere you want in the United States. I think those are better ways to approach this. And I'm glad we're having these conversations because there are structural issues on the ground that can't be left in an abstract concept. They ultimately have to be what the community is capable of withstanding. And we ought to figure out how to distribute that better across the United States.
Jen?
So, you know, one of the themes in what I just heard you say, Andrew, is that like we need to have ideas and we need to implement them. And that is the job of Congress. And I think this is another example where there is anger being applied at the Biden administration as law enforcement officers, where it really should be placed on Congress. So, for instance, we've been told that it is the delay in work permits, which is what's causing so many migrants to be stuck without money, having to sleep on, you know, in shelters and airport floors. And this is why the cities are having problems. And yet there is a federal law that says that you have to wait 180 days if you're seeking asylum to get a work permit. So everything Biden's administration is trying to do is trying to get around that law, trying to find loopholes to speed up that process, where it's Congress that can change that that law and speed this up in a way that you don't have to try and find the loopholes. When it comes to why are there so many people that are qualifying for asylum, that's something that is determined by Congress, not the Biden administration. All of Buttigieg's ideas, they might be great, but it's Congress that would have to put them into place. He can't do that. These have to become laws. So implementation of any ideas when it comes to immigration has to come from Congress. So the fact that we have people in Congress that are yelling at the Biden administration, it's just not going to be helpful. It's Congress that's going to have to be the one to make laws to deal with our immigration problems. We have a very weird, tough to navigate immigration system. We have known this forever, and yet the fingers are always pointed at the administration, and it's just not going to get solved this way. So I just... that's where I get frustrated. Like the aim needs to be moved. The eye of Sauron needs to be moved from the executive branch onto Congress, because that's where the solutions are ultimately going to come from.
I do think that this is helpful in that we have not just red states that are feeling some of the pain here, in that maybe now we can have an honest conversation about comprehensive immigration reform, because now it's not just a situation where Democrats are pointing at Republicans and saying, like, oh, you just hate brown people. That's why you're mad about what's happening on the border, where there is a problem with if you have an overcomplicated system, if you have a system that is being taken advantage of by folks who want to come into America. And I don't blame anybody for wanting to come into America. I do think that if we make this into a situation where everybody that comes in and seeks asylum beyond what we might traditionally understand as a traditional asylum plea, it does open up the avenues for a lot of ugly stuff, child trafficking, drug trafficking, that is certainly going on at the border and has had measurable effects on cities like San Francisco, specifically with you know, some of the Honduran gangs that have taken over the streets with open air drug markets. Like, this is a real problem. There does need to be a bipartisan solution to how we are treating our border, how we are reacting to people that are amassed there. And I think we have gotten to the end of the solutions of let's try to hack what we have, because the Trump administration tried to hack it one way and say, all right, we're going to invoke these health things and we're going to separate migrants at the border and we're going to be punitive to keep people out. And now the Biden administration was like, well, we don't want kids in cages because we ran on kids in cages. So we'll do kids in large fenced areas, and we'll try to hack the work permit thing so people can maybe get a job faster. And it's a mess. It's an absolute mess, and it requires a large solution. I've yet to see anybody either running for Congress or running for Senate or running for president to have any kind of big ideas on this, but boy, do I think politically you could do something grand right now, because the political environment is very frustrated on this. And right now there's less and less of a willingness to just say, well, there is no problem, just to gaslight the other side. There is no problem. You're just bad. And that's, I think, where we were up until really now.
Yeah. And I, you know, we kind of, Brandon, not us, but like the busing that was done by Greg Abbott in these southern states to take some of these migrants and put them in blue cities was really panned as a horrible thing to do. But it does seem to be sending the message that was kind of needed, you know, because like for a long time.
And apparently what one of the things in this story was like, yeah, you want to know what happened is that it became a big story in the migrant communities of like, oh, sometimes you can get a free trip to DC or a free trip to New York. And it actually just created more natural traffic of people saying, oh crap. I'd rather go there than
El Paso.
Like, sure. Yeah. I'll go to Boston.
No, that's true. But at the same time, like, I think you're right that maybe the blue cities needed to experience it themselves because it has been dismissed for so long. Like, I'm speaking as a Southern right. Californian. It was dismissed for a long time. It's like, oh, you guys are just racist. You just don't like Mexicans. And it's like, no, it's not that. Like, there's a lot of people actually coming. And so I think you are right that there should be political opportunities here. But what I witnessed in my studying of Congress is that they don't want to deal with this. They like blaming the administration because they then, don't now, have forever. The ideas.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So it's like, I think that it's going to be up to, again, the voters to push people in red state, blue state alike to be like, no, there needs to be a immigration system that makes sense here. And you need to prioritize this, even though it's hard. They like doing the easy stuff. This one's going to be hard. And that's why.
Because it's going to require trade-offs. It's going to require... Yeah. The Republicans are going to be able to take home and said, we secure the border. We built a gigantic wall. We have a billion people there. They all look like weird futuristic knights from a steampunk novel. And they're going to scare anybody that comes by, and you're allowed to blow dart anybody from the Sinaloa Mexican drug gang. Right. Like that's going to be the Republicans thing. And the Democratic thing is going to be, look, we're going to reduce the work permit situation. We're going to make more people that will legally be able to become citizens of the United States of America, or at the very least work here. And there has to be trade-offs. There has to be. And you know, there was a moment during the Trump administration where reportedly, we have no idea whether or not this was an actual thing, but reportedly Trump's bargain was build me a wall and I'll make permanent the Dreamer program. And he was going to do a trade-off for that. And that wasn't going to happen because at that point, as is now, the Democrats saw a lot of political utility of Donald Trump just being mad and frustrated and being a lunatic, which they are still hoping will win them the White House in 2024.
And the wall became a racist monument by that time, where like, I thought the wall was stupid, but it went from being stupid to being a racist monument that we yes. cannot in any way do because we are racist if we build the wall.
Yeah. I've long thought that the wall would be ineffective. But
the great PJ O'Rourke said a wall with Mexico would be $1 billion subsidy to Mexican ladder companies. And I think he was right. But the idea that like you couldn't have any type of speed bump between, Baja California and El Paso. And if you did, it would be something immensely racist is going a step too far there.
Well, by the way, we have two borders. Like if they just come in through Canada, like that's also yeah. a border, and no one's talking about putting a wall there. So I think there is something to the idea that there was a little bit of racism in the wall because the Canadian one was never a part of the conversation. Well,
but we don't have the mass migration problem on the northern border that we have on the southern border.
I don't know those numbers.
Yeah, we don't have caravans coming from the North Pole.
The majority of illegal immigrants that are in the United States have overstayed their visa, and they could be entering through Canada or through Mexico. But again, a wall wouldn't stop them either way because they've overstayed it. So there's lots of functional reasons for that. And generally speaking, Jen, I would agree with you on that. And I do think that I don't think it's racism so much as xenophobia, but I do think that there's a lot of xenophobia that makes people anti-immigrant. But I can appreciate that. Even if you're not anti-immigrant and you're getting overly saturated in your community with the sheer amount of people you can come through, having to figure out a better human infrastructure network to be able to ameliorate the folks coming in. And I don't really know, like in El Paso, I have no way of knowing who just doesn't like Mexicans versus who is like, there's too many human beings coming down my street. And were we able to figure out a way to kind of balance all this out, I think it'd be more palatable too.
Yeah. Human beings, not only on your street, but I mean, Justin and I lived it. Human beings with nothing to do and with no way of making money, they will steal, they will sell drugs, they will do what they have to do to survive. So that's why it's dangerous for the community to have these souls that are not able to make honest livings. Like that's one of the reasons these cities are like, we have to do something about this because it's dangerous for the community. It's not because where they come from or their color of their skin. It's the fact that they have no economic way to survive other than turning to unconventional means.
Which is where my immigration proposal comes in. I've been saying this for years. Anyone can come to America and immigrate here as long as they open up an ethnic restaurant. Nobody has problems with ethnic restaurants. No fucker in Texas has a problem with a family-owned Mexican restaurant. True. They're awesome. We all goddamn know it. And if a couple of terrorists slip in, I'm fine with it as long as the food's good. I'm willing to take that
oh
risk.
Oh my God. But I think Justin, you really nailed it that like politically to solve this, there need to be political trade-offs. I think conversations like the one we're having are really useful. I think that's the conversation we need nationally, which is why I have so much frustration that this conversation for the last 20 years has been about Biden, Trump, Obama, Bush. Like that's the yeah. national conversation needs to be the one we're having. And so when I see articles like the one that you sent to us, or like all of them really about immigration, focusing on the law enforcement, I think that it's not bringing us any closer to a solution.
Well, I don't want to spare the executive branch here. The executive branch has an outsized power over the legislative priorities of their party. It is not in a vacuum that Chuck Schumer or Kevin McCarthy or anybody that is leading the majorities in those houses are deciding what they are going to push forward. Well, Kevin McCarthy has a lot more of a chaotic pathway to decide what he is going to push forward in the party because he has a very slim majority and very loud members. But in general, if it's Chuck Schumer and Biden's in the White House, they're figuring out together what they're going to push forward. They were in lockstep when they were trying to push forward Build Back Better. They were in lockstep when they eventually settled on having it be the Inflation Reduction Act. They are in lockstep with the big priorities there. So I do think that the executives do have a role in this.
Of course they have a role in this, but I am seeing absolutely no effort whatsoever in the House or the Senate to make a law that does anything about this because all of the pressure is being put on the administration. Like right now they're talking about impeaching Secretary Mayorkas. Like this is not the right conversation to be having about immigration. So that's what I mean. Like the pressure is being put on the executive branch and the members of Congress are kind of sitting back and really not feeling much pressure at all based on the behavior that they're exhibiting. Like they are down to punish, not to solve.
Blame game, baby.
I was talking to a friend of mine here in Scotland, and he was looking at when you've got complex decisions, the way he broke it down was there's the person who owns the problem. There's the person who executes the problem or executes the solution. There's the person that makes the decision, and there's the expert. And a lot of the time, these are very different people with very different situations. And having worked in government, like I think that this is fairly rife. So like I was very, very low level in Congress. Like I don't think you could get any lower than me and still make any money at all. And we had this weird job where we were passing out a limited amount of White House tours to constituents, which didn't make any sense because the White House was the one that was actually running all of this, but they would basically farm out the nose to us because whoever's in the White House doesn't want the president doesn't want people going, the president turns you down.
Yes.
That's not fun. So they farm it out to Congress. That way Congress can go, sorry, there's not enough spaces this week. And then Congress, on the other hand, like a trick that Congress likes to do that I've seen is empower the EPA to the EPA will determine the cleanliness levels of the water or something like that, because then they can take positive elements from that and then come in later and be like, oh, the EPA, they're hurting jobs. So they can kind of outsource the negative elements to it. I think that's almost certainly happening, Jen, you're right, with immigration. Although again, I do think that the executive branch, Justin, I think you're right, does make a big difference in terms of the execution of this. It's like, somebody's in charge of the DMV, and sometimes they want people to get licenses and sometimes they don't want people to get licenses. I don't know a whole lot about what's going on with the Biden administration, but the Trump administration was anti-immigrant. And I say that not based on any inner ideological struggles going on, but because every actionable step that could be taken to restrict immigration occurred during the Trump administration. The goal was to limit immigration legally. And my friends that have worked as immigration attorneys tell me that it was significantly more difficult to get a visa during the Trump years, because they didn't want people to get visas. There's hate all
around.
They
were shutting things down until they found out what was going on. One of the greatest lines in political commercial history. Trump's first political ad was, we're going to shut down immigration from Muslim countries until we figure out what's going on. Figuring out what's going on being the operative phrase of an actual presidential candidate. We don't know if they ever did.
For you guys, I'm curious if you were crafting a, hey, red team and blue team, here are the good things that we could all agree on, or here's what you get, but we can do this. What would you do that you think would have buying power?
I unfortunately am not up on this enough to give a blueprint for a grand bargain, but I would sniff
it
around. I would sniff it around to look something like, you need big wins coming back, and you need to ameliorate the fact that each party is going to take big losses, because they're going to have to give something up that will be painful for them. It'll be painful for the Democrats to say that the border is something that needs to be more firmly protected. It is going to be very painful for Republicans to say that it will be easier for people that are either in America or looking for work in America to get legal documentation to do it, whether or not that means citizenship or something south of that. That means that the wins that you need to have need to be big enough. You will essentially need for each party to be able to say Trump was right and Obama was right. That's what you're going to need both. And you're going to need the Democrats to say Trump was right. You're going to need the Republicans to say Obama was right, which means it'll probably never happen. But for there to be an actual reality here, it does need to be from the will of the people. And it does need to be something that has a political fidelity to it.
I feel like it would have to be some kind of mix of making it a little harder to claim asylum, to limit the number of people, but at the same time, when you qualify, speeding up the process, getting those work permits quickly. Yes. I think it'll have to be a mix that looks something like that.
I think you could do that. That makes sense to me. If I were a Republican senator and I was like, hey, we've made sure people aren't abusing our asylum system, and we've actually restricted the amount of people coming in. And in return, fellow Republicans, we got rid of some red tape for businesses looking to hire people. We made it easier for people to engage in commerce rather than I think that you could do that. I think that'd be a sellable proposition.
Republicans get a catapult to fire people back over the border to Mexico, and Democrats get a free vaccine for everybody who makes it.
Done.
We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. Somebody once told me we're not wrong pod at gmail.com. RIP to a real one, and also RIP to Jimmy Buffett. As a Florida man myself, I
was going to ask if you were okay. I read that today, Justin, morning. And I thought of you. I was like, are you like that was the guy that played Pee Wee Herman died. I had to reach out to one of my comedian buddies to be like, hey man, I know that our relationships with our heroes are odd. So anyway, you're okay.
Yeah. You know what I found out in some of the press around his death, that he wrote the beginning of Margaritaville here in Austin, Texas at a tequila bar in Austin. Apparently he was breaking up with his girlfriend at the time that lived in Austin, and flew back to Key West. And that's where he came up with the general idea of it. And it's according to him, in some interview at some point, but apparently the original idea for the song was Wasting Away Again in Austin, Texas, Phil. And then he figured out a better title that eventually became a multi-million dollar empire for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Apparently one of the last songs he wrote was called My Gummy Just Kicked In.
With Paul McCartney. McCartney. Paul McCartney's on that song.
I love him so much.
Yeah. So good. Anyway, RIP to some real ones. Green with Anger writes, calling the Green Party unserious is such bullshit. Theirs is the hardest working of any party and people. Like, you shitting on them flippantly on your podcast just makes you sound like a tacit supporter of the corporate political parties and makes me wonder whether whether you are worth my financial support. So I'm going to add here that this was specifically directed towards me. And I he mentioned before that the reason why parties like No Labels and the Libertarians have more ballot access than the Green Party is because they have corporate sponsorship. And I want to take this opportunity to point out the dangers of fatalism. That if you have this fatalist idea that your ideas and your political party will never win because of whatever issue, be it that there is economic disadvantages or other people have a level of shamelessness, whatever it is, it's a cope to fall to fatalism, to say that I am always going to lose. And I don't believe that that is a way that politically you can draw more people to your side and attract more support. And at the very least, look, the traditional role of third parties in America are that you make ideas so popular, they become subsumed into the larger swaths of the Republican or Democratic parties. That is traditionally how it goes. I hope that one day I live to see that a third party can take the White House. Whether or not that's possible, it doesn't stop your ability to want to dream that it is possible and work to scheme to find ways that you can make it happen. So while being realistic in understanding how these things happen is good, to just be fatalist and lash out at me and say that you're going to take away the money that you pay for the podcast, for which I didn't even check if you did, I think is bad form. And you want to know beyond bad form? Bad for your health, good sir. Bad for your health.
That is a lot more magnanimous than I thought your response was going to be. I'm very impressed, Justin. Like, I was kind of pissed off reading it, and I wasn't even the person it was directed at.
Yeah.
No, people like get mad.
They
people
do.
People get mad. It's fine.
I feel like the tone could be a little nicer. Also, taking away your support for this whole show, considering I'm on it and very much on your side on this. Like, I don't really know how that works, but yeah.
Well, no, it's because we're tacitly in support of corporate political parties.
And then on my end, don't give me money to confirm what you already think. That's not why I'm here.
I know.
We're on my show.
All three of us are going to piss you off at some point.
I'm not here to make you feel comfortable about your priors.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, I'm the one who was nice to you. Look at that. Doesn't that fuck with you?
Yeah, just as the nice one.
The point that we were talking about, though, was money in politics. And I do think there is something to the fact that the Greens are behind because they don't get the corporate money. So their message, it could be very popular, but if you don't have the means that the competition does to get the message out, I mean, it is a disadvantage. And I think it's a point well taken, if not very nicely put forward.
I mean, yeah. Ideas. People like ideas. Sometimes ideas attract money. Just saying. If you have popular ideas.
If your ideas are anti-corporate, they don't attract corporate money.
Are you kidding?
Money is the big money.
Who do you think? Half these organizations that are stopping traffic for climate, climate emergencies are funded by heirs of oil tycoons. Like, eventually these people have kids that have a lot of money and give money to these kind of causes because they feel guilt about it.
I don't think that the people with ExxonMobil money are showering the
people that are kids of the people that got rich doing that. That is a thing. Look that up.
Will, can you plug in a 45 second clip of me talking about ranked choice voting in open primaries? I feel like that would be called for, but I've done it several times.
Taxing empty houses writes, it doesn't seem unfair to me to open such locations to a vacancy tax if it's also used as a rental property, at least for a portion of the year. You could set aside a number of days or a number of days in a season for a ski town type location. It would either A, incentivize keeping prices of short-term rentals lower because an otherwise unused location might be rented instead of fallow and having to pay the tax, which would have the added benefit of having more tourism dollars in the towns instead of them being ghost towns, as Jen was relaying in Park City this summer. And B, incentivize more long-term rentals so that the tax is never applied and would allow those workers that live nearby to have more affordable housing and not need to commute over an hour to their job.
I mean, that is the point behind a vacancy tax, where you incentivize these people to rent out the units instead of having them sit empty 51 weeks out of the year. Like, that's the idea behind it.
Rather than hitting from a policy dimension, I'm going to come from a feelings perspective. And I think that some of the umbrage that goes into situations like this is that there's rich outsiders coming in that are somehow destabilizing the community. And I don't think Park City is a good example of that. I've only been there once, but it's absolutely beautiful. But from what I remember, it was a mining town that had turned into a ghost town, and tourism is the thing that turned it around. Like half their tax base is from these exact people we're talking about. The public services that are provided in Park City come from the people that are just there part-time. And so I think these are all a good thing, having these people come in. And I would be reluctant to view them as a problem that needs to be taxed, because it might dissuade them from coming in and end up killing the goose that lays the golden egg.
Yeah, but there's also, like, I was talking to my mother-in-law. She's from Seattle. And we have these giant towers in Seattle, residential towers. And there's investors coming in from other countries, buying pieces of property and having them sit empty because maybe their student will use them someday. We do have a problem, like Oakland, California. After the 2008 crash, there was a bunch of people that got evicted from their homes. I'm not entirely sure how legitimate that was, but there was a bunch of people that got evicted. These corporate investors came in, bought up the homes, and they just sit on them. And there's neighborhoods that are just empty to this day. So we do have a problem with, we have housing, but it's just sitting empty. And when you have a lot of that, and then you also have a lot of people living on the street, there's a mismatch there.
Well, and this goes back to what we talked about briefly last week. I'm a grow the pie kind of guy. So my thing is, I think that the predominant problem with housing is that we're overzoned. We make it difficult to build new houses. There's lots of examples of corporate offices that don't have any corporations in them right now that could be housing, that are not turned into housing because it would be illegal to turn them into housing.
We got another email about this. So before we go into our full discussion on this, let me read this. It's a bad idea to tax empty houses, right? I'm very surprised that Heaton missed an opportunity to point out an economic factoid and discuss housing policy re-vacancies. It might be time to consider an assisted living facility for Heaton, where he can live with other well-dressed and polite people from the 1960s.
Sounds great.
Vacancies are good because they provide liquidity in the housing market. Some houses or apartments need to be empty so that people can move between homes at any given time. The average is about 5-8%. Poor people move far more than rich people. So this is a policy that would disproportionately target poor Americans. And vacant houses aren't a moral problem. They are a component of any functional housing market. This is why the 16 million empty homes rhetoric is silly. It's about in line with what you would expect from a functional housing market. Now, it's possible that Jen is totally chill with vacant apartments, and this is just a targeted policy for ski towns.
Okay, vacancies that are for rent or for sale are one thing. We're talking about things that are vacant and owned and not available for anyone to move into. So there's a very big difference here. And that is what I'm talking about, where we spend the money, we use the land, we build the infrastructure to connect the roads and the electricity and the cable and all that stuff. And then the house sits empty. And it's not just one house. It's entire neighborhoods. It's entire towers. If you convert an office into a residential tower and it still sits empty because it's investors from China that are coming overseas and just buying on it and sitting it and waiting for the value to increase so that they can flip it. Like, we're talking about vacancies on a massive scale. And so when the solution is, let's just build more so that more investors can come in and buy these units and have no humans living in them. And yet our neighbors are living in tents on the street. It doesn't help our communities to have empty towers while there's people living in tents in the doorways. So that's the problem with the vacancies. These are not vacancies that are up for rent. These are not vacancies that are available for first-time house buyers or for even second-time or third. Like, these are owned units. So this is not the scenario that you're saying is good, because no one can buy those things. They're just sitting there. That's the problem.
I think this is a situation that would benefit from more freedom rather than less freedom. Right now, the majority of housing in the United States in any urban area is prohibited by law from being dense in any capacity. You look at any major city in the United States, 80% of the land in that city, you can't have anything more than a single family dwelling unit. So people that have their own private property are forbidden by law from using it to build an apartment complex or affordable housing or a duplex or anything else. My thought is, start with the freedom and say that we're not going to force people to build a rich person minimum lot size a home for only single family dwelling units, because our whole goal is to rack up property value in the area. Turn freedom back over to people so that they can actually build stuff. And let's start there. I think that freedom is the starting point to this.
But here's the thing. We gave people the freedom to build residential towers in downtowns. And if those towers are empty, then what will more freedom do other than give other landowners the opportunity to build housing that investors will buy, and that will be empty? Like, do you see the problem? This isn't a zoning thing. I'm with you on the zoning.
So your thought is that if we increase the supply of housing, it will just automatically be gobbled up by foreign investors?
It could be. That's the problem. Yeah, because we've built housing and it's not going to the people. We're seeing more and more people living on the streets, and yet we do have vacancies. And so I do think that at some point, these communities would probably like to get humans off of the sidewalks and into the vacant units. And it also fucks with supply and demand, because we build more and more supply and yet no one's moving into them. So that's
the only way to stop a bad guy with an unused residential downtown tower is a good guy with an unused residential downtown tower.
Yeah, kind of. So, I mean, what the reason the vacancy tax makes some sense to me is that there are costs to the community of having these vacant units. And so if the investor doesn't want to lose money on that investment, they would be incentivized to allow someone to live there, not for free, but to rent it out at market rate and have people move in there. And then if you have an entire residential tower and all of those people are now incentivized to have someone move in there, then the market makes more sense, because the actual supply you have would match the demand. But right now, like, we have so much supply and yet it's just sitting empty. So I just feel like by having a consequence for having it sit empty, a financial consequence, like, you have the option to have it sit empty. If you're a rich person, you don't want any pores coming into your house, like, fine, but then you just pay the tax. Or if you don't want to take that financial hit, you say, and like, okay, here's an example. My dad, right after he got divorced, wanted to live in a very nice area in Santa Monica. And so he had, yeah. And so his landlord, he had fun in Santa Monica. Yeah. But what he did is he signed a lease where his lease was 9 months, because the people that owned that unit, it was their second or third home. I don't know. They were super wealthy, but they were only there during the summer. And so my dad would live there 9 months out of the year, and then they would take it 3 months, and then my dad would move back in. And that is the type of thing that someone would do if they were incentivized to have a tenant, if they wanted to make money on that investment, as opposed to you can have it just be vacant for free. No problem. Like, maybe that's the choice they would make. So I just think that the societal costs of vacancies could be somewhat mitigated by taxing that problem in our society.
If the problem is that people are greedy, I don't think we have to incentivize them to make
money.
That's
not what I said.
I think that will happen in and of itself.
I'm not making this a moral thing. I'm not calling them greedy. I'm not calling them evil. I understand wanting to have a vacation home and not having strangers be in it. But if it's all about an investment, if there's no cost to having it sit empty, there's cost to the communities to having it sit empty. There's cost to those restaurants and bars in Park City that can't open because there's no one there. There's costs to maintaining roads to nowhere where no one's there. Like, there's costs to society to having those vacancies. So I think just incentivizing those people to think twice about letting that unit sit vacant, there should be a financial cost to those investors. That's what I'm saying. But I'm not saying they're greedy or evil. This isn't a bash. We're not saying
that they're Dracula. She's not saying that they were bitten by a vampire that's lived 5,000 years.
We're doing policy. We're not doing moral stuff. I appreciate that. I'm glad for the clarification. with Park City, though, like, Park City's about 8,000 people, 10,000 people, something like that. Like, about half of the government revenue comes in from people that own second homes. The whole city is based on tourism.
Yeah.
So to me, saying that that's a cost is coming at it from the wrong angle. It's not a cost. It's the thing that's driving everything. And so viewing that as the engine is the way to move forward on it.
But they're not making as much as the city of Park City would. If those rich people are going to own their second homes regardless. But the fact that they're sitting empty means that in the peak of summer, when I was there, that bar was closed, all the restaurants were closed, the ski lifts were, like, there was only one open that you could use to do the sightseeing. The fact that there wasn't a ton of people staying there and enjoying the community costs the city of Park City. They're not getting the taxes from all the burgers and the drinks. They're not getting the taxes from the hotel tax that you would have if those people were allowing the Hyatt. Cause like, I was staying in a Hyatt, which was private residences. Half of those people aren't letting the Hyatt rent out their units. So the city loses out on the taxes from all those things. They're not getting the tourism because of the property hoarders that are just sitting there and keeping it vacant until they decide to show up one week out of the year. They're not getting the humans that they're getting from that investment.
I love this. This is great. You're bringing up opportunity cost, which is a wonderful economic concept. And I'm glad that we're there. People are coming in during, the idea is that tourists only come in and stay at these houses. There's like that it doesn't have tourism other than that.
When it is a ski community in the winter, they show up, and then despite the fact that it is gorgeous and temperate weather during the summer, it is harder for people to come in to give it another season of tourism because the rich people they have other things to do during the summer.
So the idea is then that there would be tourists there at capacity all year,
yeah,
but that there's not sufficient tourism there because no one's built the hotels or whatnot.
Well, so that's what I'm saying. The housing is there, but for me to go there as a tourist, Joe and I like totally splurged. We were there for 4 days and we paid $385 a night because there was limited supply.
Damn.
I know. So there's limited supply there right now, even though when you physically go there, it's empty. There's a ton of supply, but because the rich people aren't allowing people to use it while they're not there, it contracts the supply. So that's the price I have to pay.
This sounds like there's a great incentive to build more hotels. Like if they're
not really.
I suspect that there would not be the same amount of people in the summer as in the winter because it's for skiing specifically. And I think they do have the Sundance Festival around there. But my suspicion is that it's not going to be 100% capacity all year round.
But you're missing the point. If you build another building full of units there, there's just going to be more rich people that want it as their ski chalet, and it's just going to be another empty building. So
what we could actually, and I don't know the answer to this, what would be interesting to look at that would solve this very quickly is just what the occupancy is in the hotels right now. If they're at capacity, then it would indicate that there's a problem with the overall supply. If the hotels are not at capacity, then it would indicate that that's not a problem. I don't know, but it'd be interesting to look into.
So I think you're missing the hotels are private residences. So I stayed at a Hyatt, but every single unit in this Hyatt is owned by a rich person. It's only the people that choose to let. Yes. So the Hyatt is basically managing private residences, and the people that just choose to not have people like me stay in their unit, that unit stays empty all year. And so there's plenty of supply. I promise you, there was more than 1,000 units there that were completely empty. But because they are not being rented out, because there's no financial penalty for leaving those empty, the people that want to go to Park City in the summer are paying rates like $385 a night, even though there's 1,000 empty units. So it's an artificial limiting of the supply, the actual housing units where people can mm-hmm. put a bed and like use the kitchen. They're all there. They're just empty. And so that's the problem.
Empty of people. I'm sure the rich people are leaving their shit in there, right?
When leaving I was on a Cuisinart the gondola, were places that had gorgeous like jacuzzis and you can see in the windows and like they're fully furnished. They're just waiting for their owners to come back. And so
I want to be that rich.
I do too.
I want to be so rich. I want to be so rich that I piss off Jen Briney. That's my new goal.
Here's the thing. I was raised in Orange County, California. I know very rich people with multiple properties. I don't think they're bad. But I don't think they're bad people. Like, I don't like being branded as a hater of vampires? The rich. Justin, fucking shut up. I don't think rich people are bad. I understand that if I had a second property, not wanting strangers to be in it. But if I had a financial penalty for leaving this piece of housing, because that's what it is. It's an essential thing that people need to live. If I owned multiple pieces of housing and there was no incentive or no disincentive whatsoever for me to leave it vacant, I understand wanting to do that. But if there was a tax that it meant that this property that I bought was going to cost me money, I would be more incentivized to be like, okay, Hyatt, I know that you're going to make sure everything is clean. I know that there's going to be a closet where I can lock up my personal shit. I've signed a contract with you. You're going to take care of everything. I would be more incentivized to make that deal if I had to pay a tax, because I could at the very least have that tax paid for by letting a human use this property. And if I did that, the community would get the taxes from the tourist that is using my property, because they're going to have to eat. They're probably going to spend money on recreational things. It's better for the community as a whole that there's a person there when I'm not.
Yes. So in this instance, you were staying there at this Hyatt condo system.
Yes.
Where you were staying in there. How do you know that all of the other unoccupied condos in this Hyatt were there because no one would let them do it, as opposed to just people didn't want to be there because it's off season? How did you make that determination?
So I made friends with my neighbors who actually do live there full time and just kind of like asked them, why is everything empty here? And they explained that, you know, even in the winter, they said that on the weekends it's completely full, but on the weekdays it's a ghost town again. And they just said that most of their neighbors, the deal that they said the Hyatt made is if you rent out your place with the Hyatt, then the owner gets 30%. And so when my neighbors aren't there, they go with a different company to rent theirs out and they get 70%. So it's all about like the contracts, but the Hyatt makes it super easy. So they have that housekeeping and they take care of everything. So there's pluses and minuses to it. But see, they told me that most of the people that own those units, they only show up once in a while. And it is what it is. And most of the time it's completely empty. So that's how I have this information. I got it from the locals.
Okay. All right. I'm calling this one.
All right.
We'll, I'm sure we'll have another housing conversation down the line. Money from committees writes, if you let the party committees be the central clearinghouse for all raised money, then it will assure that no one will challenge the establishment in a primary. If the case is decided, as you guys assume it will be, and guarantees that all professional talent will only go toward candidates committed to defending the status quo, regardless of the political will of the district and state. Any operative or consultant that dares to challenge the establishment will be frozen out of employment contracts with any other candidates blessed by the campaign committee. It's not that the money in the account of the candidates determine the outcome, but it's all about the incentives that are against any candidate's campaign that is even perceived as rocking the boat.
That's the concern. Yeah.
You make some good points. And I think the incentives tend to be more outsider versus insider than they do for anything else. A lot of the incentives with campaign finance reform tend to be around small donations and things like that. If you make a system where you are prioritizing small donations over big donations, you're going to have a system that prioritizes populist candidates. So whatever you do with the structure of this, it's going to affect one or the other. And at least in terms of making that division between establishment versus outsider, that's probably the most relevant one when it comes to campaign finance reform.
A lot of congressional campaign specifics in that Newt Gingrich book, and a specific reference to how the Democrats kept their majority for so long by increasing their franking privileges, Heaton.
That is a, see, that's a big thing there.
You got to read this book, man. You got to read this book.
If you're a member of Congress, I, of course, can send out a newsletter to all of my constituents on what I've been doing as their representative in Congress, can't I? And it looks very suspiciously like it's just me pointing at things that I built. One would argue that it's really just campaigning literature and that they're getting about $200,000 worth of free campaign literature per year by virtue of being in the establishment.
The Democrats, according to him, Gingrich, were the ones who upped it to four mailings a year. You could mail all of your constituents four times a year. And I don't know if that has changed since then. I haven't read far enough. Point of fact on Hawaiian Power writes, Hawaii, like most states, does not leave it to the private sector to operate their electrical grid as a free enterprise. Instead, the industry is regulated by the Public Utilities Commission, a governmental entity. The electric company cannot raise rates without PUC approval. And I'm sure that there are other areas of regulation that constrain what they can and cannot do. It's possible, although I do not know, for example, that a company needs permission from the PUC to shut off power.
It's in control of the power is controlled by the company. I mean, this doesn't contradict anything that we said last week. Like, yeah, the government oversees these monopolies. I don't see how this is anything different from what we said last week.
It's just saying a point of fact is all.
All right.
Public Utilities Only says, I've said this a million times, public utilities and services cannot be privatized. These essential services that are for all of our benefit must be in the hands of government. They cannot be private, for profit. Profit with human nature will always trump the public good. Fuck neoliberals and privatization. They're destroying the country.
This college sophomore is incredibly correct. It is absolutely correct. Anything which is essential should be a public good. That is why I have repeatedly called for nationalizing the shoe industry. Everyone should have shoes. No one disagrees with this. Therefore, it should be a public good. Same with groceries. Can you imagine if groceries and shoes were left to the private sector? No one would have shoes.
Good, Andrew. Have you been practicing
Thank
your
you.
Burning?
Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you.
Being heard by your government writes, I'm from Pittsburgh. About a year ago, a bridge collapsed in the city. I'm going to add editorially, you have enough of them. One of them collapsing. It's not a big deal. Fortunately, no one was killed, and rather amusingly, it was on the day that Biden was scheduled to talk about infrastructure projects. It feels like our government has not been particularly good stewards of our roads. For years, we were told that the condition of our infrastructure for our 23,000 bridges in the city, 15% of them were rated in poor condition. It has felt like we have little recourse in addressing these problems. I feel like every politician uses roads and bridges as part of campaign promises. But to my knowledge, there's not been any responsible party identified in the matter, although lawsuits have been filed inquiring into the collapsed bridge.
I mean, this is why we just had a massive infrastructure bill signed into law last year. I mean, infrastructure used to be something that was bipartisan. It was one of the easiest things to get through Congress. And then we got to this partisan madness that we've been living through during at least my lifetime. But we did just have the infrastructure law. And so hopefully that'll make things better. But yeah, it's unfortunate that our infrastructure had to degrade to the point that it has to get that into law. We shouldn't let it be like that. But
well, let's focus beyond the money, right? And you know, infrastructure needs money to be upgraded. And I do think that there's a reason why that has been something that the Biden administration is going to run on. But the point of the email was they can't identify anybody in charge of the collapse bridge now. And that there should be somebody, if the public utilities are something that can be controlled more effectively than a private company, knowing who's in charge of it would seemingly be a critical part of it. Right.
I guess, but I don't know enough about the situation to tell them what I know. So yeah. I don't know how to respond to that.
I'm glad you brought this up. As we talked about last week, I'm agnostic insofar as energy grid utilities go. I think Jen made some very good points about the nature of kind of the infrastructure itself being under public control. But in a more abstract sense, I'm glad you bring this up, because here in Scotland, where I've been the last couple of months, there's a presumption that if you can just take things away from the greedy private sector and put it in the public sector, it will automatically be fixed because the incentive structure will be properly aligned. And I don't think that it's an automatic given. The examples you give of infrastructure problems that are public to begin with indicate that it's not going to automatically be better if we make it public. It might be, but it may not automatically be as well. So we have to figure out how to competently structure the system to get the best bridges.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Nebraska can do, right? There's only one state of the union that has 100% public power like Jen calls for. The commies in Nebraska. The Cornhusker state also has the only officially nonpartisan unicameral state legislature and just broke the record for the most attended women's sporting event in history and is one of the only two states to split its electoral votes. Should more states emulate Nebraska? I don't care about Nebraska, so I'm going to avoid that question. But I do want to talk to you, Jen. That gigantic crowd, yes! I think it was like 90,000 or something like that, was for women's volleyball, right?
Yes, it was. They had it in a football stadium. I'm so happy that that happened. It just shows that there actually is so much interest in the sport. And I know that a lot of people started tweeting at the AVP, which is the Pro Beach Volleyball Tour, being like, go to Nebraska, like they're going to fill your stadium. So yeah, it was amazing for the sport. It was so exciting. Yeah. Go Nebraska. That's very exciting.
Do you know the backstory on that, on how, like, are they massive rivals? Does Nebraska have a big volleyball history?
I don't actually, because that's an indoor, like I follow the beach tour more than indoor. Yeah. So I don't know how that happened. I just know that a bunch of players were excited about it. So no, I don't know the background, but I think that just showing that level of interest in the sport, whether it's indoor or outdoor, it's a good thing for the sport in general. It's very exciting.
Political ads, right. I'm going to assume that Jen doesn't watch YouTube or is blessed to have tricked the algorithm into thinking political ads are outside her purview, because I cannot adequately express the tsunami of political ads that I've been forced to watch 5 to 15 seconds of when watching videos on the platform. My TV subscription is not necessary to watch these dollars burn.
You're correct. I don't watch YouTube, so I feel for you. Good luck with the next year and a half.
I apparently have lucked out because I'm not getting inundated with them. I do have like weird video suggestions in general. Like the algorithm's taken some odd turns, but I don't think I get the political ads that much.
Tom Steyer is the reason why I paid for Hulu without ads. Because we were trying to get through like an episode of Handmaid's Tale and it was every ad break. I'm Tom Steyer and the world's dying. I'm like, enough, Tom, enough. He had to make it up to me by having his wife twerk to Juvenile on stage in South Carolina. So
was that real?
Did she do that?
I was there. I was in the building when Juvenile played Back That Ass Up and Tom Steyer very awkwardly danced and his wife, who is a free spirit, as much as a woman of her age can throw it back and bust it wide open. Boy, was she.
Was it like, did the crowd cheer? Were people into it? Or was it like, ooh, awkward old doing weird things?
All 15 people in the Tom Steyer crowd were electric.
Well, so it was at a predominantly black college. They were there to see Yolanda Williams, the gospel singer, DJ Jazzy Jeff, and Juvenile. Amazing. Juvenile was supposed to go on first. They pushed him to the end after Tom gave his speech. This was the end of his campaign, the final event. And then Juvenile came out. And one of my favorite parts of being on the trail was as soon as the Steyers, father, son, and two kids came out on stage while Juvenile was playing the classic anthem, Back That Ass Up. Somebody next to me just goes, Tom doesn't know the words. And it is stuck with me forever. I cannot wait to get back.
But how did they like the wifey's dance? Were they into it?
It was so bizarre. It was just one of those bizarre things where, number one, you're getting to see Juvenile play Back That Ass Up like 5 feet from you. So it's like, it was a cool thing if you're a fan of Juvenile or the song Back That Ass Up, which I am a man of a certain age who is both. So it's already exciting. And then Tom just starts doing this like awkward white guy thing. And then like his wife starts like kind of gyrating. Amazing. Look at it. That's on YouTube. You can maybe get a political ad when you go see what happened on that stage. Just truly remarkable. Truly remarkable. It was so good that the coronavirus had to come in and kill the rest of the campaign. It was never going to get better than that. Finally, what? Writes, hey, Justin, Dave Smith isn't running for president on the Libertarian ticket. Get with the times. Heaton, this is a personal problem I have with you. You're supposed to know these things. How am I supposed to know that Dave Smith isn't running for president? I've been making these Dave Smith jokes. You have not corrected me. This is your fault.
I am not up to date on the intra-party dealings of the Libertarian Party. I've actually been paying more attention to this thing going on in Argentina than I have in the United States with the Libertarian Party. The Argentinians might elect a Libertarian here shortly, but I don't know. I thought Dave was running too. He didn't say it, but he was indicating it. So I am as surprised as you.
Are we talking about the same Dave Smith, like goes on Rogan comedian?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, so to fill in a little bit of this, Dave is part of the Mises Caucus within the Libertarian Party, which tends to be kind of hardcore anarchists, yeah, as opposed to minarchists who want limited government. And they had done a takeover of the party where they all kind of got their people into the local committees at the local level, and through that took over the national party. So there was this huge power struggle within the Libertarian Party. Dave is on the side of the insurgents that took it over. So a lot of people just assumed he was going to be running for president because he'd probably be able to take the Libertarian nomination. We're told by this anonymous person that is not happening. So I have no idea who they will be nominating then.
Yeah, I don't either.
I hope it's somebody who doesn't want to give you a license for your damn toaster. One of my favorite quotes from the Libertarian debate. I guess, what, 8 years now already? Damn. We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is the inimitable Will Saddlebag. Heaton, what's cooking on the orf?
I had a fascinating but weird episode on the show this week. I made friends with a guy that's about my age, and we were talking about how my high school reunion was coming up, and he was like, oh, I got invaded by your country when that happened. And I was like, really? Indeed. What happened? And he's from Babylon in Iraq, like the historic Babylon. And we had a conversation about what it's like when you get invaded. I was really interested to talk to him, not so much about the invasion itself, but there was like a 6 month period where there was no government in his town. Like, it didn't exist because the government had collapsed. And I think his uncle and some buddies just ran the fire truck, just as dudes. I was very interested to talk to him about that and what he would think if it had kept going on. And then I was really interested to talk to him, like, you're from a country that had intense authoritarian propaganda, followed by invasion, followed by occupation, followed by whatever's going on now. He now lives in Washington, D.C. And I was like, you have a great vantage point over America now that you're an American citizen and you're living here. So I'm very curious to see what you think. And we talked about, like, what scares him about living in the United States as somebody that's become an American. So it's a much more conversational episode than I usually do on the Political Orphanage, but a very good one.
Wow.
Jen, congressional dish.
Yes, I got my junk fees episode done. So, it's actually getting a lot of positive feedback because I think people are learning how different industries are tacking on fees. And I know I personally learned a few things about how, for instance, like when I look at concert tickets, I now have a number in my head for how much you can kind of guess the fees are going to be instead of going through the whole, you know, process and figuring it out. So, and then there's some hope in this Congress for doing something about it. So I analyzed what the Republicans said was cool and the Democrats, and there's a path forward. That's what the episode is. Go and check it out.
On PX3 this Friday, well, first we have a question of four different senators that have not yet said they're going to run, including Bernie Sanders. So I do think it's a non-zero chance that this is the end of Bernie Sanders' national political career.
He seems tired.
He had a heart attack in 2019. He'd be 87 if he did serve out another term, which is, you know, close to where Dianne Feinstein is now. So, I wonder. So him, Mitt Romney, Kyrsten Sinema, Joe Manchin, we talk about what their state situation are, what their potential primaries would be. And then on Friday, I had this moment watching Nikki Haley on Meet the Press, where she was talking about what we were talking about earlier, about the old people in Congress. I'm like, oh, you want to know what? I know somebody who's really, really fired up about that. And also, she is really, really into a woman being president and has a thing for women for whom have held high levels of office. And so the triumphant return of my mom to the PX3 program.
Yay!
I was about to say, this sounds like Gloria Young coming on.
Oh, yep. Yeah. So I had her do some research on Nikki Haley, and I'm going to see whether or not Nikki Haley passes the Gloria Young test, which would be a thing because she is not, I don't think since Reagan has thought about voting for a Republican, but we'll see. We'll see whether or not she is a Nikki stan on Friday's edition of PX3. But until then, if you're a patron, you have another topic coming up. We're going to talk about telling people to, you know, to laugh at their family member's death on the internet. If this is it for you guys on the free feed, then for Jen Briney, Andrew Heaton, Justin Robert Young, we're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.